This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded December 15, 2017. It's been a bit, but we're here. Not dead yet edition.
Hooray.
So let's, what have you guys been up to? Pregnant pause.
Who's going first?
You go first, Case Guy. We never hear from you these days. What have you been doing?
Mostly, and when it comes to software development, mostly cloud work now. So back in January, I started dedicating all my time to cloud stuff, backend stuff, ASP.NET Core, a lot of Azure. I haven't really touched Node or JavaScript at all this year. Maybe a couple little times to fix something here and there.
Wow.
So there's been that. I also cut back on like travel and conferences for a year, took some time off, except for NDC conferences. I think those were the only ones I did this year. And I don't know, just chilling.
What, I mean, when you say cloud, there's like 90 different bajillion facets to cloud. Like, what's your main focus there?
I would say just your regular enterprise or small business, just trying to move web applications and services and re-architect to be in the Azure or AWS or anywhere.
Cool.
In other words, nothing like chatbots or AI or Hadoop or anything, hosted Hadoop or anything like that, really. It's just more just vanilla authentication, authorization, how to get a web app into Azure, how to use, I don't know, storage, Redis, stuff like that.
Cool.
Microservice-y type stuff.
How about you, Kevin?
Let's see. I'm still working the same place I've been. I'm managing a lot of different projects, but the interesting one has been this project to sort of rebuild our search app, which is like a search portal for government documents, county property records mostly. So that's been, you know, we totally re-architected microservices, Node, React front end. It's been a fun project. It's been a big project, but it's been a pretty interesting one.
Is there a sort of like a microservices platform kind of thing that you use, or is it homegrown? Like, I don't know the Node microservices world.
Right. No, it's pretty much just homegrown sort of Express based HTTP endpoints. A lot of, we also do a lot of like message based microservices. So like RabbitMQ based microservices, but we don't use any of those. Like, I'm forgetting the names now, but you know, the stdlib or, you know, some of those libraries that are like supposed to mm-hmm. be whole frameworks for running microservices.
Cool. Yeah.
Using Docker by any chance?
We are not, actually. We're doing old school, you know, sort of Ansible based deployments to, I don't know, is there, do you call it like bare metal cloud? Like a VM? is the VM running in the cloud like now considered bare metal? We actually have done, we do some Docker stuff for development, for kind of, you know, because, you know, one of the pains of a microservice setup is if you need to actually run those services locally for development purposes and you have 30 of them, you know, it can be mm-hmm. a challenge. So we do use Docker for development purposes, but not for production.
Gotcha.
Is there, you hear about them mentioned together so much, like, is there a reason behind not doing it that way? Or is it, you know, like, is that something you think about, or is it kind of like, well, there's no real point in production, you just have a separate VM for each service kind of thing?
Well, it's, I think it's our ops guy at my company is on the conservative side for this kind of stuff, which I think is probably a healthy thing to be when you're in ops. And so he's hasn't seen a real compelling reason to adopt Docker stuff so far mm-hmm. in production.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Scott, are you doing Docker stuff? ASP.NET Core and all that?
Yeah, I mean, most of the stuff we're building that I've been working on is ASP.NET Core with no Docker.
Cool.
Is it running on Linux or on Windows?
Most of it now would be a Windows. It's actually Azure App Service, so it's kind of like having a Windows VM.
Okay.
A little more sandboxed and easier. It's a platform as a service, web service, a web server, basically.
Yeah, I think like when I'm describing them, the app service is more kind of like shared hosting almost. Like it's got a bunch of other like services, you know, it's got like a lot of other bells and whistles available. But like if you compare like, you know, running bare metal or VM versus, you know, like, hey, call up shared hoster and they give you like a login and you can FTP to it. Like at a very basic level, that's kind of what I think the app service is more like, you know. And then you've got all the auto scaling and the deployment slots and all that kind of other stuff. But
right. I mean, we were looking at Docker, trying to see if there was anything we might be able to make use of it. And we do still have MongoDB hanging around for the moment. Chances are it's probably going to go away in the architecture, but that might have been a use case to deploy Mongo with Docker. And the other use case, looking long-term, is eventually, yeah, maybe we do want to use the Linux, the cheaper alternative to the Windows servers, in which mm-hmm. case it would probably make sense to use Docker in development and deploy with Docker.
Another thing I've heard people like, you know, say an advantage is you can have the whole kind of, you can, you know, use Docker Swarm or Kubernetes or whatever and have kind of a whole software defined thing of like, here's my, you know, whatever it is, my database and all the things, and it just spins them all up. But cool.
What about you, John?
Yeah, I've been doing so .NET Foundation stuff, and it kind of seems to vary over the course of the year. So like some of the things that I've been up to lately, we did a we've got this Meetup Pro thing, so we're sponsoring meetups. So you know, like back in the day, there used to be all these .NET user groups under Ineta, and then that went away. And then there's a bunch of random meetups, but they're not really like, if you search for a .NET meetup, you may get one that lists .NET, but also PHP and Flash and Agile, and you know, it's just kind mm-hmm. of, there's no kind of like definitive list, or you know, like. And we had no real clue. Like if you go search for Node meetups, you can find, or AWS, like AWS, like the Amazon site has a good list of them. So we were like, okay, this, we can do a better job with that. So we've got a thing where we're sponsoring meetups to do Meetup Pro. And then it's all kind of like one big organization for that. Mm-hmm. So we just went over 100 groups that are signed up with that. So anyone listening that's like part of a user group that wants to get hooked up into this thing, like, let me know. So there's that. And then a bunch of like, there's all this behind the scenes stuff that like a lot of projects have CLA things set up, contributor license agreement. So if you have a pull request, it'll check and say like, have you signed a CLA for this in the past? If not, you go through, and in the past it used DocuSign and it did all the, it was actually a pretty hacky system to make it work. And so this new one that I kind of helped coordinate migrating to, it's built by Salesforce, and it's called CLA Assistant, and it's all built using like GitHub GIS, and it's a, you know, like a modern platform that actually works. So tons of like little behind the scenes things to kind of like just keep the projects moving and stuff. So, and then we onboarded a bunch of projects over the past, well, like in November, brought in one from Pivotal. We brought in DNN from, you know, that was .NET Nuke, Iron Python, NUnit. So a bunch of just projects, and, you know, some newer ones, and then some that are like near and dear to my heart, you know, just from that I've seen and used over the years. So, and then we rewrote the website using ASP.NET Core. So that was kind of nice to have like an actual site for me to get my hands dirty with it a bit and stuff. So yeah, that's been most of it. But it's one of these things where it's like the .NET Foundation, it's like I can't describe what I'll be doing week to week because it's kind of, you know, it's 90 different things. So
yeah, so what,
but it's fine. It's good
what
stuff.
Actually is the like foundation? Like, is it like how many people is it? How is it organized?
Yeah. Okay. So there's only really one kind of person that's devoted to it full time, which is me. So there's a board of directors, which is Scott Hunter, who's the PM of .NET at Microsoft. There's Miguel de Acasa, and then Rachel Reese, who's our community representative. So she has a she's a board member also. So anything like that we won't need permission to do, like, hey, we're going to bring on some new projects, or we're going to, you know, do anything that needs some kind of like actual adult oversight, I propose it to them and they vote on it. And then there's a technical steering group, which is other big companies that are kind of deeply involved with .NET. So that's Google, which includes like our representative right now is John Skeet. You know, we have like JetBrains, Unity, Red Hat, you know, so those are all companies that like, you know, want to make sure that .NET's going in a good direction and all that. So we meet with them. And then there's also an advisory council, which is more kind of community members, people that are leading open source projects and stuff. And then there is a staff, but usually a lot of them, like there's, you know, people to help with finance and stuff, but it's basically like the day-to-day stuff is pretty much me. So.
Oh man, just you? I'm going to start a foundation.
I know. Yeah, it's totally living the life.
Learning Code Foundation. But
I mean, it's interesting. So as far as like what it is, it's a nonprofit. It's a 501c6. So it's not like owned by Microsoft. It's, you know, it's a separate thing. And so I think, you know, part of the idea there is that, say, if you're Google or whoever, and you want to like believe that .NET is not just something that Microsoft's maybe going to yank out from under the rug, or, you know, that it actually is kind of out in the open as a real open source thing. Any .NET code is actually contributed to the .NET Foundation. So if you look at the copyright headers, you know, for core CLR or whatever on GitHub, it'll say copyright .NET Foundation. So there's that. And then kind of the general job of .NET Foundation is just support open source .NET. So that's all kinds of things. You know, there's the IP side of it. There's like we have legal service. We have not a bunch of money, but we have some money for project support for, you know, just the things that come up. Most open source projects are, you know, they're run by people working late hours and pulling out their credit card more than they probably should, you know, to do things like pay for a code signing cert, or, you know, set up a website or whatever it is, you know, stupid stuff. That's a distraction from actually running an open source project. So really it's kind of all sorts of things around helping just say like, oh, hey, join, you know, like, instead of everyone solving this themselves, you know, projects that join .NET Foundation, we can say, hey, we'll set you up on our enterprise app Veyor. We'll put you on our enterprise LastPass. We'll, you know, all this stuff so that you can just focus on running a project. So I don't know. Is that semi-clear? Yeah. It's usually this is like after all, you know, people say, oh, cool, neat. So what actually is that? I don't know. You know, and it's, including I'll talk to people like at Microsoft, people working on .NET, and they'll like be like, yeah, so what actually is it? You know, which is fine. It's kind of it's one of those things where it sounds kind of, the name Foundation sounds kind of boring. And it's one of those things where like, hopefully it solves a problem, solves some problems, but basically just makes the .NET open source ecosystem smoother and better, and, you know, provide options for projects to grow up so that they don't, you know, a lot of projects hit like growing pains where they, you know, it's a few people hacking on a project, then all of a sudden now companies are depending on them, and they've got, you know, support issues being raised, and they're like, you know, like having to pay for things, and sure, they can maybe make some money consulting, but it's not enough to really pay them. You know what I mean? So it's like, there's a lot of like growing pains to this thing. And for some projects, they're like, hey, we just want to stay small. It's a fun little hobby. That's cool. But there's a decent amount where it's like, no, we really would like, I love this project and I'd love it to grow, but I can't solve all these problems myself, you know? So I really like the promise of it. I think it's really still like .NET Foundation is kind of still pretty young compared to a lot of other open source software foundations. And I think there's a lot of like opportunity for it to grow and to continue to like work with more companies, be more open. And you know, this past Monday, I was talking to Michaela, who's helped with Mono's Google Summer of Code involvement. And we're like, hey, what can we do to like do that for all .NET Foundation projects. Make that more, you know what I mean? Like, share that knowledge and make it easier to for them down route. So anyhow.
Yeah. So what is, sorry, what, see you have what a, is Google's, like, what is Google's interest in .NET these days?
So they have Google Cloud Platform, and Google Cloud Platform runs .NET. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. So I've seen several presentations. John Skeet does presentations on this recently. So they have a really slick system. There's a few different ways to do it, and I'm not an expert. I've just seen the presentations on it, but it's definitely something where you can go through their kind of, they have a really cool browser based console thing where it'll step you through. It'll say, now click here, now do this, type this. Okay, good. You type that. Great. Now click that, you know, so it like monitors as you're typing it. And like you have an app up and running on Google Cloud Platform with ASP.NET Core, like in a matter of a few minutes. So yeah, so that's their kind of main thing for that.
I see you have a lead-free coffee mug merchandise.
Are you looking on the store?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's another thing, right? Everybody wants to be able to, you know, sell, have swag, but they don't all want to have to go and set up the accounts and manage that. I'm actually looking at, up till now, we've been doing things using the just providers where you kind of upload something and they'll take a big cut and they'll ship them out. And looking at, you know, maybe there's, you know, if you have enough of this stuff, you can work with somebody that'll be like a virtual warehouse and they'll handle inventory and shipping and stuff, but you can buy stuff with bulk discounts and that kind of thing. So in other words, instead of doing like one-off printing, you mm-hmm. can say, I want to order, a 1,000 stickers, and then they're sitting in, you know, a warehouse somewhere, and then, you know, work with something like Shopify and they'll fulfill it. But yeah. So the reason I'm looking at that lately is because Sticker Mule recently changed their policy so that they won't let you just upload an image and then they'll do print on demand for it anymore. I guess people are abusing that. So
oh,
yeah, that's a shame. It is a shame. So there aren't really any, big reliable places that'll do that anymore. Sticker Mule was great for that. So, yeah.
So, anyone done any virtual reality or mixed reality this year? Like as a consumer? No.
Okay. No.
Next topic.
Just well, a little, yeah. It depends what you mean by mixed reality. Just a little iPhone augmented reality playing around.
Okay.
Which is the sweet spot seems to be like, you know, furniture shopping for your house at the moment. But it's actually pretty cool. I actually used it at the office because IKEA's got a whole, like, you can, you know, look at the desks and use AR to position it in your space and see what it looks like. And it's actually pretty neat.
So it's an app where you would take a picture of your room and then go to the store?
No, it's an app where you, you hold your phone up to the place where the furniture would be and you say, I want to put that desk there, and it plops the desk down in kind of the virtual space, and then you can walk around it and, you know, see what it looks like from different angles. And I find it like incredibly cool from a technology perspective, you know, not something that I use on a daily basis, but it is kind of amazing that you can do this fairly easily now.
Yeah, that does seem like an actual like real life use case. You know, like I've had that before where it's like, hey, my wife wants to paint a room, and I'd be like, hey, let's Photoshop it to see what it looks like. I mean, it'd be nice to be able to just kind of click through a little bit more.
Yeah, I was thinking about these headsets finally this year after hearing so much about them all year, and then Microsoft launching this whole mixed reality thing with the cheaper headsets that look like they're sometimes $300 or less.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to get a feel for like what you can actually do with one these days and how well they work and fit on your head. And
so
seems promising, but still maybe a little early for content, at least when it comes to the Windows stuff. And most of the games I looked at were not games that I would play. So,
Yeah, I've tried on a couple of HoloLenses and like done the main thing that the most interesting demo that I tried was there was one, it was like an industrial thing where you've got an industrial plant and you can like basically pinch and zoom to blow it up and you can walk through it and you can like click on a pipe and see the, you know, like architectural diagram kind of stuff. Like those sorts of things that seems, I mean, you guys know from my deep knowledge of industrial piping that I had no idea. It seemed kind of neat though. but yeah. And then I have to say one other thing that's just kind of fun. I tried one on, they had in the Channel 9 studio, and it's like you click with your fingers, like in front of you, you kind of like you're, I don't know, like trying to snap your fingers, but failing. And it like all of a sudden it like paints these polygons all over the room. Like you can see that it's like, you know, like measuring the shape of everything in the room around you. And they actually didn't have any cool apps on it that I could use, but just doing it, that was fun to just do over and over. Cause it was like, whoa, you know, like watch all these, everything turn into triangles all around you. But yeah, I've been thinking about that, you know, cause going back a ways, like Kinect was like, whoa, this is awesome. And then I'm sure that like, occasionally I would see like a demo, some sort of thing where they would do something like medical or industrial or whatever, or in a, you know, like a casino lobby or something where it's like, whoa, that's neat. But I never got any games that like floored me, you know, and it always felt like there's this promise there, but it was like, I didn't see the software there. And I'm kind of wondering like HoloLens, I've seen some cool, like the keynote demos, and you'll see where there's, you know, like medical study kind of thing. It's like, oh, neat. We can both walk around and collaborate on this or whatever. But it does seem like something where it's like there's opportunity for somebody to do something like new and interesting. I just haven't seen it yet. But beyond the kind of, oh, gee whiz, kind of, it's a neat concept thing.
Right.
One of the cruelest things is they won't let kids try them on. Like it just in general, virtual reality things. If you go to like, I don't know, like the Microsoft store, you know, like places where like, and I guess it's like concerns about their developmental spatial something or other, but
they
it's
just
like,
don't want to be acting all so I'm like, store, hey, do they?
Maybe that, I guess that's it. My kids like, that was the meanest thing ever. They let us see you guys play with them and I can't try it on.
You know, that it always reminds me a little bit of the Segway, you know, the scooter, which is like, it's really cool and has these like, there's these very specific sort of verticals where it is a nice niche product, but it never really broke out into, you know, like the mainstream.
It's the for mall cops.
Exactly. It's got the mall cop market locked up, but
mall cops on
city. Yeah, city tours. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, there's these places where it's great and you see them, you know, it's not like you've never seen them being used. So, you know.
So do you remember when that was first being talked about? It was Project Ginger.
Yeah, it was going to be like, it was going to revolutionize the world.
And then people were speculating like, oh, it's going to be, it's definitely fusion power or, you know, like there's all this crazy ideas. And then it's like, that was the other one. Right. Yeah. So. But what is revolutionizing the world definitely is Bitcoins. That which are now, do you want me to read the prices up as they go up and
what's
down?
What's the price right now, John?
Well, it'll absolutely, okay. So right now, $17,648.49.
Okay. And how about now?
Actually, I'll refresh my browser. $7. Okay. Here's my funny story with Bitcoin. People started talking about these recently. I was like, I thought I did have some Bitcoin out there somewhere. And I realized back in 2011, people were like, you know, I don't know. It was a nerdy thing. I downloaded the Bitcoin program. And then there's a thing called a faucet where they'll like basically give you free tiny bits of a Bitcoin or whatever it was. So I played with it and I'm like, I kept it running for a little while and there's a mining pool and I really don't even know what I'm talking about. And then like after a couple of days, I'm like, this has made 30 cents. This is stupid. So I like, I like shut it down, whatever, rebuilt my computer. And then earlier this year, it's like, oh, these are like $10,000. This is crazy. And then I was like, I wonder if I could dig that up. And I actually had to like load it up and then upload it to some cloud-based thing where they'll store it until they get it hacked. And it was up to like, so back then it was like under 30 cents. And now it's like $300. And then I was like, well, but maybe it'll be 30 cents next week. I don't know. And then that reminded me of my one other cryptocurrency investment, which was Dogecoin in 2014. And I bought $10 worth of Dogecoin, and it is worth now exactly $10.
Well,
so it's actually pretty stable. And I'm thinking that's a good place for my retirement investments.
So, the thing about Bitcoin these days is like all these so horrible stories that you hear about people who like, you know, there was one story about a guy who had a USB drive with some Bitcoin on it that he like lost because he didn't think it was worth that much. And it's now worth like $80 million.
And it's in a landfill. It's,
you know, he's still like desperately trying to find it. And there's like a lot of stories like that. Or Bitcoin pizza is the other one.
Yeah. So that one, from what I read of it, this guy bought, it was in Florida, and he bought for 10,000 Bitcoin, he paid some dude to deliver two pizzas to him for 10,000 Bitcoin, which is now worth about $170 million, yeah. Which is kind of funny.
So it's brutal.
So I talked to Scott Hanselman about this lately, and he said he had somebody paid him for some random thing. I don't know. He eBayed something for $300 worth of Bitcoin like 4 years ago or something. And then he's like, but then he just sold it and then he's like, so now, but I bought this stuff with it. So like, you ever seen a $3,500 USB cable? This is a $3,500 USB, you know, because all this stuff he bought off a Newegg or whoever is taking him. The other thing I've heard is there's pretty big like transaction fees too. So it's like, oh, you know, even just to like, so somebody was saying they wanted to sell off $200 worth of Bitcoin and they spent like $15 in transaction fees or something. I don't know. Interesting. Dogecoin though, I really thought it was the one. It was really gonna where it just hung in there.
Didn't make it.
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, do you own any Bitcoin?
No, I never have. I guess if I were to elaborate on that, I'm not sure what to say. And I was interested in it when I first heard about it many years ago and thought about getting some. Then I thought, well, I don't really need to buy meth or anything like that.
Right. So maybe. Right.
Then I don't know. I just never have. I guess I kind of took the Jamie Dimon school of thought that it was just a crazy toy thing for a long time. And yeah,
it's the kind of thing where you pick it up when you want to pay off a hitman. And so it's funny too, that I was like, I'm finally getting around to getting solar power. And I was like, oh, I'll have unlimited power, you know, like for kind of, you know, cause it's sunny here in California. And then I was like, oh, that'd be funny. I guess I could use some of that to mine Bitcoin. And I went and looked and it was like, you can never make any money mining Bitcoin anymore as a normal person. Like it's all done by somewhere it was like, picture a giant warehouse full of specialized, you know, ASIC machines right next to a hydroelectric plant. Like you can't compete with that, you know, I was like, all right. Mm-hmm. Oh, and like in the jungle somewhere with people are paid $5,000 a year, you know, it's like, you're not going to make any money. So, but then I went and looked around too. There's all these other random tiny, what I guess, you know, ICOs and tiny other random coins. And then there was Bitcoin Cash and there's Litecoin and Ripple and there's like dozens of them now. And I guess it's like penny stocks. People are like, well, maybe this one will be worth something. Who knows?
Are people collateralizing these things yet and bundling them up into funds of
tranches
of funds of Bitcoin of coins?
Well, there's Bitcoin options now on the Chicago board.
Nice.
But I guess my most interesting Bitcoin story would be about not even that long ago, a couple months ago, someone on Twitter pings me and says, hey, why is odecode.com mining Bitcoin in my browser? And I was in the middle of some company meeting, and I just kind of ignored it, thinking, "Yeah, this guy is drunk. He's got some crazy browser extension that's doing something." And a couple hours later, someone else pings me and says, "Hey, you have some sort of script coming down from odecode.com that's loading a Bitcoin mining JavaScript algorithm, web worker, something. I don't know." So I dig into it and ultimately discover that, yeah, pretty much every article that I've ever posted on odecode.com had a little script at the end of it now that would load a Bitcoin mining JavaScript program from some other domain, which I don't remember where it came from.
Wow.
So you're probably wondering how I fixed this or why it happened. Because at that point, I kind of went into panic mode, and I just assumed, well, gosh, there's got to be some sort of cross-site scripting thing in my comments, and looked at that and went back through some web logs. To make a long story short, I eventually realized that someone, just through guessing URLs, had found a place where they could edit my posts, and I had forgotten to put an authorize attribute on one particular controller or action. So it was it's been open for like 5 or 6 years now. Anyone could have put whatever content they want into odecode.com.
Oh, man.
Someone wrote a script and went through and set off a request for every single thing to take its content, repost it, and put the script at the end.
Nice.
So then I was trying to think about how to...
change it so you would get those Bitcoins.
Yes, exactly. Trying to clean up the database. And of course, at first I'm like, oh man, I'm going to write a program, and I'm going to use a regular expression, blah, blah, blah. And then I just thought, you know, the only thing that changes in the database is when someone posts a comment and no one's posted a comment for 8 hours. I can just use the point in time restore from 4 hours ago, and poof, problem solved.
And then put the authorize attribute on.
And put the authorize attribute on. And I've had this on my to-do list for like a year now to buy a certificate and make everything SSL, so I did that too.
Cool. That reminds me, that's because it's been so long since we talked. Our site was totally hacked. Actually, it was totally hacked.
Again.
No, which time? Actually, more specific.
Yeah. So here's what the deal was. Here's our history of sites being hacked. Way back, like, our site's been running since the dawn of time. It's actually been a really long, it's been like 8 years or some crazy amount of time on WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
It got hacked a long time ago, like 5 or plus years ago, with this pharma hack. And I ended up like fighting it, but there was all this stuff embedded in comments and options. And PHP is really hackable. It's really easy to like, it's PHP is basically, it's possessed as a language. And so it's like just really hard to keep all those demons in it. So yes. All they have to do is poke a little hole and the demons come out. So I ended up actually writing a thing in the footer of each page that would just execute a SQL statement to delete all this stuff that was like, I knew where it was like somewhere in all this PHP was trying to like screw up the database, and I just would delete it again. And it was in the footer, so it ran last. So that worked for a very long time. Then after that, I got all paranoid and I put all this two-factor auth and stuff to rename the login page and a lot of stuff that kind of like mitigates all the scripted attacks. And then also ran on Cloudflare, and they have some pretty good like protections that go kind of before it even gets to you, like at the DNS level. So, or at the routing level, whatever. So then that was all fine. Then like a couple of years ago, my brother's like, "Hey, I've been hosting my old band website at a friend's PHP thing, and he's shutting it down." I'm like, "That's cool. We'll put it on mine." And so, because with our hosting, we have like actually we get several.
Just give us more PHP code, please.
Yeah, and I had been maybe a little cocky because it had been like 5 years since there had been any problem, and I'm like, "Oh, WordPress is great. It auto updates now. It's pretty, you know, like whatever." So then it turned out that his site actually had previously been hacked, and it had like some, I forget what you call it. It basically had like a backdoor where people could access these PHP scripts, and it would, it was a file dropper. It let you drop files. And because of that, it could do file traversal, and it infected all my other websites, including like my wife's website and all this other stuff. So anyhow, it was a mess. And it was like, but, oh, they do some fascinating stuff. It's like when you actually like, there's a side where it's like, I hate these people and I want them to get, you know, like thrown in a volcano. But then it's also like, wow, this is pretty slick. How, like, you go through and it's like, for instance, they do things where it's like, if you browse to the site directly, you don't see any of the badness. But when you are referred by Google, then like you, it injects all this other stuff. So it does that to boost SEO and all this other stuff. Right. So it's, you know, it checks referrers and it's like some pretty interesting, like from a computer, I wouldn't call PHP computer science, but from a whatever computer hackery point of view, it's like, oh, that's actually kind of slick. Like they overwrote the definition of like these core object or string concatenation or whatever to, you know, so anyhow, I finally like did a full wipe the entire server, reinstall WordPress from scratch, exported just the content and the MP3s, you know, and redid it from scratch. So, but I have to say WordPress has done a pretty good job of continually like improving the platform, and they have auto updates set up now and all that. So I don't know. So that's that.
Well, that is fascinating.
Fascinating in like a horror stories we'll tell our children, you know.
Yeah, like in an HP Lovecraft type of way.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. So year in review from a technology perspective. One thing that obviously comes to mind, there's the net neutrality thing.
Oh, which this is recorded on the day after.
Yeah.
So anything could happen.
So it's been, I guess, through, it's voted in committee, but now it needs to be like voted by somebody else.
Oh, I don't know.
I think there's a thing where like what they did, because, and I'm believing what I saw on Twitter, you know, so who knows, but people said like, reminder, it's not law yet. It's been like, this is the committee, which then refers it to some lawmaking body.
Okay.
So.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. But, too, there's the whole thing where it's like, hey, make sure you, like, file a complaint, let your voice be heard and stuff. And I don't think that really has any effect. You know, like.
No, they don't care.
Tons of people registered. They knew it. They're just like, yeah, we're going to do this, you know. And there were so many automated comments that were like proven automated. I don't know if you guys saw that. Mm-hmm. They ran some interesting things where they basically were able to see that someone had mail merged a kind of a form letter and posted like millions of comments. It wasn't just a straight up mail merge. Like it would alternate, you know, different phrases and things like that. So somebody on Hacker News had done kind of a thing where I forget what Spark or something. They did something where they analyzed it, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else interesting this year?
Well, hold on before we move off of that. Do you guys have predictions on what the, you know, what the result of this will be, rolling back the net neutrality stuff?
I mean, one obvious thing that I would think of is for like video is expensive and it's like, I don't know how well it can be compressed or cached or anything like that. So from a provider, like say for instance, my network or my internet provider is Cox, who would much rather sell me cable TV than have me watch everything on Netflix. So I could see them, you know, doing things to affect quality of service or somehow charge me more for watching video on demand. That's the main thing that I am expecting. I've seen other people say like, well, this is how they'll, you know, sell, you'll have to go to Verizon's whatever version of this website. I kind of feel like they're going to want to do things as behind the scenes as possible, but it's just things that are going to make more money without people knowing to complain.
Mm-hmm. I got to think it's eventually going to come back, be reversed, this decision. I mean, might even take a few years, but eventually someone's going to try something that has people up in arms and makes this demonstrably true that not having net neutrality is a bad idea.
I have seen some people list some things where they'll say, this isn't just theory. Here's a list of 10 times over the past 10 years where internet providers have been caught doing things that, mm-hmm. you know, that are clearly like not in consumers' best interests and would be prevented by net neutrality. And so, but the difficult thing is we really don't have a say. And all of our listeners who are not in the United States are laughing at us right now. But like in the US, we don't really have too much of a say. Like for a lot of people, you only have really one high-speed internet provider. And we don't have really great mobile or cellular internet providers too. Like I know in some countries, it's like, hey, I just get great internet off my phone and it's unlimited and it's really cheap. So we don't really have that too much either. So it really is kind of we're kind of stuck with limited options. So it really does matter to us. And then, you know, the US for good or for bad is kind of central to a lot of internet services. So things that affect us, you know, can ripple through to other people around the world too. So
that's one of my concerns is there's really only one good provider that I can use to get broadband connectivity and they're, in the scheme of things, relatively small. I think they only operate in Maryland, West Virginia, Ohio, so just a few states. And it would seem to me like they would be the perfect place to start a trial of, hey, what could we do that now that net neutrality is gone to make more money or whatever? Because, you know, there's only a few hundred thousand people that could complain as opposed to a Comcast or somebody.
Mm-hmm. And even if you do complain, like, what are your options? You know, really, I mean, it comes down to okay, if 5% of our subscribers leave, but we make 7% more off our other subscribers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's something I would have to have. I could sign up with three different cell providers to try to get connectivity that way, but it would be very painful, I think. It's interesting. I've had T-Mobile for years, and now they have this deal where you have, I don't remember, it's two subscribers on an account and you have free Netflix, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I feel we switched to T-Mobile recently also, and it's been pretty good, partly the whole unlimited on each line, because my kids were driving me crazy. They all have iPhones, and iPhones seem to really, like, as much as I would go through and change all the settings, there were all these kind of, oh, you have to also change this other secret setting or else it'll default from Wi-Fi back to cell network if the cell signal is stronger or all, you know, and Instagram and Snapchat, all these things just suck so much bandwidth. So I was always playing whack-a-mole. We kept on going over on our charges, and at least with T-Mobile, it's unlimited on every line. And the worst that will happen is they'll throttle you per line. Which I don't care if they get throttled because, you know, tough luck.
Right.
and then the other thing I love with T-Mobile is the overseas roaming has been really helpful.
Yeah.
It's like anywhere I go, I don't have to run around, buy a SIM card or anything.
Yeah, I love that.
What are your thoughts, Kevin? What nefarious plans?
I don't know. I mean, I'm lucky enough to live in a place where I do have some options. So I have chosen a internet provider who is been a strong advocate for network neutrality and says that they will continue to be so, even though I actually pay more and have a lower bandwidth than I could if I used like a Comcast. But they also don't have bandwidth caps or, you know, they don't have, what do you call it? You know, like total usage caps. But, you know, I also just want to support a business that, you know, is aligned that way. But I know not everybody has that. To me, the big question will be when the companies do inevitably try to abuse their position as they have done in the past. Will anybody mm-hmm. do anything about it? You know, cause when in the past they have, you know, like AT&T, what was it? AT&T tried to block FaceTime over video or I can't remember which one it was.
I just looked up a list, not to derail, but just to like, you know, back up what you're saying, I guess, 2012 AT&T, block FaceTime. 2012, Verizon was blocking tethering. 2014, AT&T had a new sponsored data scheme where content creators could buy their way around data caps. Back to, I mean, just going back and, you know, all kinds of things where there was people blocking people's payment systems, like 2011 to 2013, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon all blocked Google Wallet because they had their own ISIS payment system. Right. So, it's a kind of thing where it's not like a theoretical, like, oh, they could do some bad stuff. It's like, no, they definitely will. Like, it's just a question of
they'll get in the past, and they were eventually stopped from doing those things. So the question is, in the future, will they be stopped from doing those things when then they inevitably try it? And that's what worries me, because I don't feel like the current folks in charge will be super inclined to take the side of the consumer over the side of the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me like whatever impetus would push people towards getting rid of network neutrality are the opposite of things that are going to make them care about, you know, any of these other things. Hey, it's free market. That kind of feel. I just internet's different because of like people are limited on providers. It's not easy to like shop around and just say like, oh, this month I'm going to use this other provider. And, you know, and then it is like a source of information. And so there's kind of free speech sides to it too.
Yeah. And the other thing is that this is BS reasoning that they give, like, you know, it will free up the providers to innovate. It's just such a crock. It's one thing if they could have any reasonable explanation for why they would, you know, why this would be beneficial, but they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Innovate in what way? Like, I agree. I haven't heard a single example of like, oh, this will allow me to pay more for internet. Like, I don't, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the list of things that they were blocking, it was all things like BitTorrent and payment wallets, things that were innovative that they tried to actually stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flip side of all this, my understanding is there's been content providers like, you know, the Netflix or the whoever's streaming movies to their customers, where the ISPs will go to them and basically ask them for money, more money to be able to do that to their customers.
Yep.
Yeah, what a mess. Yeah. Hey, Kevin, do you have an iPhone
X, did you say? iPhone 10? No, I do not.
Yeah.
I
know when you like Mac OS X, iPhone X.
Yeah, no, I was tempted. I still have a 6S, which is, you know, so technically I was quote unquote due. I think on this one though, I'm going to wait for the second generation and let them, you know, work out the kinks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hear, you know, like always, it's like, I'll hear a lot of, whoa, this is amazing. And then I'll hear some also like, some people have trouble with battery life. The notch thing seems really weird to me. I don't know. I've heard people say some.
What's the notch thing?
Is that the X that has the notch at the top?
Yeah. From what I've heard though, in actual practice, it doesn't seem to bother people. It seemed like a theoretical issue more than a real issue. Oh, the little cutout at the top where the face detection camera and you know.
Mm-hmm. So the deal is in order to eliminate the bezel, basically the screen goes all the way to the top, but then you've got to have this cutout for the face detection. I think the speaker's up there too.
Oh.
So it's a little notch that's like maybe an inch long, I guess, and you know right
the,
up
the
at the top.
Into
it's
the
not
screen
big, but
and
if you
like actually carves out a part of the screen,
that's. So, for instance, if your phone is sideways and you're in landscape mode, like it's actually, you know, like cutting in, or is it? Do you indent your? Like, I don't even know from that. So, some apps have needed updates for that. It seems kind of arbitrary. Like, I don't know. I would think that would be like putting a notch in the, how do you say it? The operating system area instead of the client area. Like I can see like the operating system can be like, okay, this is my place where I'm drawing, so I can work around this. But if you're putting it in a place where web pages and apps are going to be drawing, that seems a little funky. But I don't know.
I did play around with one at the store. Either of you guys played around with one yet?
I haven't. Yet.
No.
It's funny to me, like that home button is so like hardwired into you know, my fingers, that it's a really hard habit to break to not use it. You know what I mean?
So what's is it a software? Home
basically,
button
the then? If you swipe up from the bottom, that's the same as doing a home button. And I'm sure, you know, after a day, you'd be totally used to it. But like, it was just felt so strange to, you know, to not have that thing there. So it's kind of the escape button in a way. You know, it's the like, get me out of here kind of button. And
right,
you know,
right.
It made me like sort of weirdly uncomfortable to not have it. The other thing is that, you know, they changed the UI. So you lose the swipe up from the bottom, which on older phones is to bring up the control panel, which I use a lot. So what they've changed it is now if you swipe, like on either side of the notch, there are swipe down areas. So if you swipe down on the left side, it's different than if you swipe down on the right side of the notch. And I think it's if you swipe down on the right side, it brings the control panel. But that is a kind of a finger twisty move for me. And I actually have pretty decent sized hands. So like getting my finger up to the, and I should say I use my left hand a lot for the phone. So getting my thumb up to the top right of that big screen to drag down, it's a bit, you know, not ideal for me.
Yeah, and I'm so used to, I guess it would be sort of a double click of the home button to switch between apps to get the list of apps where you can just swipe through them. And I mean, how would you?
Yeah, I guess the gesture is if you drag up from the bottom like you're doing the home gesture, but then you sort of drag up like halfway up the screen and a little bit to the side, and it switches into multitasking mode. I tried it. It's definitely not. It's not a totally foolproof gesture for me. Like, you know, I can do it. I can't do it 100% of the time.
Yeah.
I've never liked any of the edge gestures on any operating system. I never seemed to quite get them right, whether it's Windows or Apple stuff.
Yeah. Windows 8 always frustrated me with those. Swipe in from the side. And it's like, okay, but it's the whole kind of like muscle memory when you're dealing with a touch screen is weird. You know, where it's like you can get it, but it like mostly works. It's sometimes that uncanny valley. It's similar to like voice control, where it's like it's maybe going to work, but I'm maybe going to have to repeat myself four times.
Right.
You know, like yeah, we just got I finally got some Amazon Echoes and Echo Dots and stuff because they were on big sale over whatever it was, Cyber Monday. And the one thing that they do on that, which I think is cool, is that you can, and I'm sure everybody does this probably, but you can assign them all to a group. So you can say, play, you know, Nyan Cat on everyone group, and it plays, or, you know, play Christmas music everywhere, and it plays it on all of them all around the house, and they're all in sync and stuff, which I know you could buy like Sonos or all that stuff in the past, but they're like hundreds of dollars or whatever it is. This thing is like, I don't know, they're like $75 each or something, you know, I mean, so it was kind of nice to be like, hey, we have a round the house speaker system, but it is funny. You find yourself arguing with it. Like going back to what I was originally saying with the, you know, it's like, how do I phrase this in the form of a question or, you know, like say it just right. So,
you know, the funny thing for us about, we have an Echo Dot also, and our primary use case is the primary use case that I've always had with Siri also, which is setting timers. Like it's like basically setting a timer as a service. Like 90% of our use cases is that. But
it's setting a timer or a reminder too. I don't know if you do reminders much, but I'll be like, remind me to pick up my kid at 5:30.
No, I generally use my phone for that,
you know,
and not the Echo. Yeah. But the thing about the timer is that, it's what you were just talking about, where like it's easy to set the timer, but once it starts going off and I have to stop the timer, like the alarm, half the time I have to say it three times.
What about you, K Scott? Do you have any voice assistants?
The Echo, yes. And I would say it's in the kitchen, and setting it as a timer is something I do frequently. And I just got a couple power supplies and plugs that are Alexa enabled. So I can tell her to turn something on or off now too.
I just realized today talking to family members that I could probably outsource another thing, which is where, like, I don't know about you guys, but as the nerd of the house, like, people ask me stuff that they could just as easily Google. So I'm going to start telling them to ask Alexa this stuff. Like, how many hectares in a, you know, whatever. It's like, go ask Alexa that business.
Perfect.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try I have one of those smart plugs too, but I have not hooked up our Alexa to it. By the way, am I the only one that thinks the product should just be called Alexa? Like the Echo branding? It's like everybody just refers to it as Alexa.
Right.
I did hook it up to, like, I have a Harmony remote for controlling all our TV and components. And I did hook it up to that. And that's pretty cool, actually, to be able to say, you know, Alexa, turn the TV on, turn it to channel 25. Like if I'm like in the kitchen, you know, like cooking, and I can tell it to turn the TV on, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, that was something that they had with Kinect for a while. I never used it for that, but people would say, like, oh yeah, you can tell you can switch channels or tell it to pause or whatever. But
I used to get so frustrated at the Kinect. I set up my Xbox to do face recognition and all this, and I expected to just be able to walk in the room and sign me in and do whatever I want. And I swear I could stand in front of that thing for 10 minutes and it would not recognize me. My oldest son will literally walk through the room. He's not even in front of the Kinect for 2 seconds and it'll say, "Hi, Alex."
Yeah, I really do feel like we're kind of in this point in time thing. Like we were talking earlier about the augmented reality and all this stuff. And it's like where we're like right now, we're at a point where like nothing really works that great. Like we've got the old school computers down, but web browser. Hey, we're recording a podcast in a web browser, like sitting down at a computer works. Okay. Phones are cool for, you know, like most, but like all that kind of like this kind of next thing where it's like computers are smart and listening and thoughtful and helpful and all this. It's like, yeah, most of the time you're like, okay, stop.
You know? I actually do find that the, like, if you're doing one of the Alexa, the Echo's built-in functions, I'm actually pretty impressed at how well it does that you can just sort of like call from across the room and tell it to do something. And it mostly understands. If you, you know, they have this whole like programmability framework, right? Where you can extend your Alexa to, you know, control various things. And I find that those, aside from a couple that are that seem to have particularly good integrations, like you have to know the magic incantation to get it to trigger the right thing. Those I find not that practical, because I can never remember. Like I have to say, ask, you know, Harmony to turn the TV to channel 20. You know, it's like you have to know the exact phrasing to trigger the.
I think the word you're looking for is syntax.
Right. You have to think like a computer. But the built-in stuff of like asking, you know, what's the weather today? Or, you know, how many hectares in a whatever? That stuff does work almost magically well, I find.
Uh-oh. Sounds like talking about robots has maybe turned Kevin into a robot. Scott, any smart ideas about how to get us out of this situation?
Alexa, shut down podcast.
That is actually pretty good. All right. Well, that's all the time we have. You know, when we say that, we're just making that up. We have as much time as we want because the recording's free, but I'm sticking to it. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. We'll catch you again soon.